How is it we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elements?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. In this episode, we're diving deep into genetic technology. To teach us about optical genome mapping and transcriptome analysis is Dr. Peter Nogg, who earned his doctor title twice with an MD, PhD, and you've got quite the background in clinical molecular pathology. And we're going to be, as I said, diving deep into genetic technology. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome, Kara. Happy to do it.
Yeah. So I thought we could start out by, you know, talking about the challenges associated with diagnosing rare diseases, where I'm learning about 50% of people with rare disease receive a diagnosis, despite there's just so much extensive testing that can be done. I mean, what are some of these challenges before we get into how technology and testing that you use can solve some of this, just to paint the scene a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, about 1 in 100 people is born with some sort of genetic defect, more or less severe. And then, you know, the diagnostic rate for these people has increased over the years with the advent of cytogenetics and later microarray diagnosis and then targeted genetic testing, sequencing. But the genome is huge. It has 3 billion nucleotides in it, which you can imagine if you think of your life in seconds, that's about the length of your life, 3 billion seconds, right? So many of the mutations that cause disease are located outside the targeted regions, the most commonly pathogenic regions. And also, microarray and cytogenetics have a limited resolution. So they only can see changes of a certain size. So we have two problems. Smaller structural changes in the genome cannot be seen very well with these technologies. And only a very small segment, less than 1% of the whole genome, is analyzed generally. So that's why so many people stay without a diagnosis.
And you've introduced different tiers of testing, and you've talked about some of them just now. We have like basic exome to expanded exome to whole genome, and then this kind of newer concept to, you know, myself and listeners is the optical genome mapping. How do these tiers cater to different clinical needs? What information does the different tiers provide? I mean, you talked about exome. That's only looking at 1% of the genome. That's looking at the active parts. What about when we look at whole genome and especially the optical genome mapping, like even what that is, how it works?
So optical genome mapping is most similar to classical cytogenetics. When they take dividing cells, which have metaphase chromosomes, and then they look at the chromosome bending pattern, and they can identify missing pieces or if pieces of one chromosome are translocated to another chromosome, right? But the resolution is very low. They can only tell about 40 million base pair worth of DNA moving around. Smaller than that, they cannot tell. And so optical genome mapping is kind of like classical cytogenetics on steroids. So it can notice these structural changes if a piece of a chromosome goes to another chromosome or it gets turned around. And it has a resolution about 1,000 base pair, 1,000 to 10,000, depending on the region. But, you know, it's many, many fold more powerful. We're going from 40 million to 10,000, right? So it's many, many more powerful than classical cytogenetics.
Yeah, that's impressive.
That's why I like to combine these two technologies, sequencing the whole genome, making sure that no variant is left behind, right? In using sequencing technology, and then also doing optical genome mapping to allow the structural changes that were invisible until now or very difficult to decipher to be known. And that's how we can diagnose cases that other people cannot, by combining these two approaches.
So it's really when we have a small piece of DNA that can't be detected by a karyotype. So usually karyotype is what, 7 to 14 megabases? Usually that's kind of the cutoff. Anything smaller than that, we can't pick up. I'm trying to remember back to my days.
Well, it depends, really. I have 40 megabase in my head, but yeah, it depends also the application. People and the expertise of the people who do it. It requires years of training. And some people are really, really good at it, and some people are less good at it. It varies with every laboratory, and it varies from the source. It's the resolution is different if you take it from... determine it from the blood, or if you take a tumor, tumor resolution, tumor
tiny stubby chromosomes,
worse resolution. So it's very variable and requires immense expertise over years. You learn that thing over years, even decades, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
While optical genome mapping can be learned pretty quickly, maybe in a week or two if you have the good foundation of general genetics and understanding, what DNA is about and so forth.
I did my undergrad degree in cytogenetics. So, I became a genetic counselor, got my master's and focused on that. But yeah, going back to karyotyping, it took me like 2 years to say I was sufficient at it, and now it's been a while. So it's kind of I don't know if it's like a bike where you just kind of go where you left off. There's some skills still there, I'm sure, but it was very, very hard to learn. And just, looking at it, it's kind of like a really hard puzzle, which is fun for some people and not for others. What about a microarray? Because the way that I describe microarray to patients, when we're talking about, usually I'm talking about it in the sense of an amniocentesis, which that could be nice chromosomes, could be not, kind of depends. But in terms of nice chromosomes, I mean, in terms of, being able to have really nice resolution and easy to create a karyotype from it and analyze it. But I kind of describe that as like going more in depth than a karyotype when I'm talking on the patient level. So what about optical genome mapping compared to a microarray?
Yeah, so the main difference between the two is that microarray usually only recognizes changes that lead to either a gain or a loss of a piece of DNA, and it has to be relatively large to be noticeable by most microarrays, bigger than 10,000 base pair or so. So the resolution, unless it's targeted and you build a special microarray for analyzing special regions of the genome at higher resolution, generally the resolution is about 10,000 base pair, right? And so it can only detect gains and losses, really. So no inversions can be detected, no translocations can be detected, unless during the translocation, certain flanking regions are gained or lost. So if you are really good and careful, you can potentially pick up translocations, but it makes it very difficult. Inversions, again, the same thing, If you suspect that there is a flanking gain and loss, then and you can pick that up, that's fine. But it's generally these kind of changes are not detected by microarray. And so optical genome mapping is good at picking these up. Also microarray cannot size like Fragile X, really. The repeat expansion disorders like C9orf72, myotonic dystrophy, it totally cannot do those. And optical genome mapping actually can do the repeat expansions that are large. It's not useful for relatively short repeat expansions that affect the protein coding regions, right? But intronic and non-coding repeat expansions that are very long, it's really good for those. Also, it can detect contractions of large microsatellites. Like, for example, FSHD diagnosis is exclusively done now these days by optical genome mapping. Nobody uses, well, there might be some people who still use Southern blot, radioactive Southern blot, but that's very tedious and difficult. So optical genome mapping is better than microarray for these reasons, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because when one of the reasons why we order a karyotype with a microarray, at least in the prenatal setting, and also this applies to others, but I'm kind of thinking prenatal, is because you might have a balanced situation. So a balanced translocation, like you're saying, where two chromosomes swap information that someone still has the right amount of information, but it's in a different spot and it could be activated or inactivated in a way that it normally is not. Same with the inversion. You're just moving that material, but it could affect the way that it operates. So that is one of the reasons I think about, okay, karyotype is really important because we want to see where information is on the chromosomes. But the way you're describing it with optical genome mapping, would it potentially replace karyotyping? Or will there still be cases where, well, we need a karyotype because optical genome mapping can't do XYZ?
I think karyotyping is a great tool, and I don't think it will be fully replaced by.
That's good to hear. My degree will still be worth something.
because Robertsonian translocations cannot be picked up by optical genome mapping at the current state. You have to understand that optical genome mapping gets its power from a direct microscopic examination of DNA molecules that are about 300,000 base pair long. And so the pattern of a 6 base pair recognition region across these 300,000 base pairs is this barcode based on which you can position that piece onto the genomic reference, right? Or assemble it by itself into a de novo assembly of a genome. But it has to be, the pattern has to be anchored on both sides, both ends, by multiple markers in order to know the size of the intervening area. So if you have a repeat that's larger than 150,000 to 200,000 base pairs, the anchoring doesn't work. And so then that's why optical genome mapping is not good to detect translocations that are involving the centromere or the telomere. Even ring chromosomes are problematic. So there is definitely a place for classical cytogenetics, but optical genome mapping can very beautifully complement, you know, the findings of cytogenetics. So if a cytogenetics is negative, then I would go to optical genome mapping. For tumors, it's different. I would immediately go to optical genome mapping because culturing tumors is difficult, time-consuming, and often you lose the actual malignant cells. So optical genome mapping, I would say, is the primary tool for diagnosis, cytogenetic analysis of malignancies. For inherited diseases, constitutional disorders, I would say that cytogenetics should be done in parallel, if possible. If not, you know, I think the pickup rate of optical genome mapping generally is greater, especially when combined with whole genome sequencing, which is how it should be used. I would not recommend optical genome mapping to be used on its own, maybe with the exception of malignancies. But for constitutional diagnosis, I would always use it together with whole genome sequencing. Because whole genome sequencing gives the precision. Optical genome mapping doesn't tell you exactly where the breakpoint is. you know, about 10,000 base pair plus minus. So it becomes problematic when you don't know whether it's an exon is missing or it's really just an intronic segment that's missing. And so to be able to differentiate exonic or intronic deletions or structural variants, you have to have the whole genome sequencing. And exome sequencing cannot give you that information because then you just sequence the coding regions. So unless both the beginning and the end of the structural variant is within that coding region, you're not going to be able to see the breakpoint.
Let's get into the other genetic testing technology I previewed at the top of the episode, transcriptome analysis. What are we analyzing here? What helpful information can we learn from it?
Transcriptome sequencing is basically analyzing the RNA that is copied from the genome, right? So transcriptome sequencing can tell you two things. One thing is that the expression of a gene is changed significantly in the tissue that you are studying. So maybe tenfold, hundredfold. Most commonly that happens in malignancies, right? That a strong promoter is put in front of a gene and suddenly it's expressed in a tissue where it's not supposed to be expressed and in a time when it's not supposed to be expressed and at a level much higher than it's supposed to be expressed, right? So you notice these kind of things. And then the other thing that you notice is, of course, when there is an alteration in the splicing pattern, the processing pattern of the gene. So that usually happens when you have a mutation that affects splicing. So in the exon intron boundary, there is a variant that will lead to skipping an exon or multiple exons. And then really without transcriptome analysis, you will never know what percentage of the copies made from that gene end up with the proper order of exons or missing one exon or missing multiple exons, right?
There are certain conditions where it can be really helpful to know if exon skipping is happening and if so, like what exons are skipped. Can you think of an example of a condition where this is helpful?
Duchenne muscular dystrophy is a prime example of this kind of problem where a missing exon can create all kinds of alternative splicing variants of the transcript the ratio of which will influence the phenotype, how severe it is, and also how liable or how potentially this patient is a subject for gene therapy or other medical interventions, you know? So we need to know the splicing pattern resulting from the changes in the DNA, and we need to know the expression level changes that are resulting from the structural variation that we pick up, let's say, with optical genome mapping. So transcriptome analysis is really a functional assessment of the consequences, the actual functional consequences of the changes that we discover with optical genome mapping, classical cytogenetics, or whole genome sequencing.
It's surprising we don't do this more routinely of analyzing RNA, especially in the cancer space too, of like, well, what genes are activated? And, you know, you described the DMD exon skipping. I think that's a great example. On episode 247, we actually dived into that for a whole episode, just kind of how that works. But yeah, are you surprised that we're not doing more of RNA analysis, especially to figure out a VUS, a variant of unknown significance, to give us a bit more data to classify it better?
It's very interesting why this is not done more. I think the problem is that most people just don't know that it's even possible to order such a test. And then they are worried that they're not going to be able to understand and explain it to the patients. You know, people, I think it's an education issue mostly. I mean, I have customers who order transcriptome tests routinely, but still it's a very difficult concept, I think, for most people to understand that it is only useful if you use it properly. Like if you have a missense variant in the middle of an exon, there's no point really to do transcriptome sequencing, right? You only want to do transcriptome sequencing where, you know, there is an exon missing, or there is a splice site close variant, or potentially there is a promoter missing, or the whole gene is missing, let's say, or you suspect that there is a methylation, there is an imprinting problem, and the gene basically is not expressed, the gene of interest is not expressed at all. So Prader-Willi is a very good example. You know, you can beautifully diagnose that with transcriptome in a way. And so I think it's just an education problem. And also until recently, there was no reimbursement for it. I believe that there is still no real CPT code for constitutional transcriptome analysis, but it does get reimbursed. So Valley Children Hospital is one of the customers that we have, and they are successful in actually getting reimbursed for their transcriptome. So I encourage everybody who has, you know, an intron exon boundary variant or a promoter deletion. Of course, most exons would never see such thing, right? A promoter deletion or a large intronic deletion, you know, that just barely hangs into the exon, you know. So they should, if the gene of interest is expressed in the tissues that they can access, you know, roughly 60% of the genome is expressed in blood, but not everything is expressed in blood. So obviously that has to be checked with us if the gene of interest could be analyzed from blood, right? But other than that, I think it should be ordered more than it is. And I have always been a big proponent, obviously, because my research studies, they were focused on transcription, transcriptional regulation, epigenetics. So I used transcriptome a lot. And so I'm very comfortable with it. But that might not be the case for a lot of the laboratory directors or a lot of the decision makers who decide what the lab should focus on. The extraction of RNA is time consuming, and it can be tricky. And RNA is very labile, so it has to be done properly to give you the correct result. And you have to know a little bit about transcriptomics to analyze the data and so on and so forth. So there I think it's mostly educational issues that hinder its use.
And that's tough because in med school, doctors aren't really taught a lot about genetics. That's something that I'm always asking of residents that shadow our clinic. And, you know, I'm like, well, how much genetics are you learning? And I'm disappointed to hear that it's kind of here and there. And I have a cousin that's in med school, shout out Brian Deneen, that, you know, he's in his second year. And every time I see him the holidays, when he comes back home, like, so, you know, my question, how much genetics are you learning? He's like, nah, Kira, we're not learning much. So it, you know, I hope that we can start integrating a lot of this knowledge into med school, but also other schools like NPs, you know, so many other ordering providers of genetic testing, because I think that really is a big issue, you know, as well as just how many labs are doing this, like you said, because it's a bit finicky to actually be able to do. Another part that I was thinking about is if, you know, as we're getting an increasing demand for personalized medicine, how do you think that this approach of, you know, using these two types of technology is going to provide more targeted and effective treatments for patients as we progress into more and more of this precision medicine era?
Well, you know, you have to separate the two fields, like the constitutional diagnostics and the cancer diagnostics. I think the cancer diagnostics is the easier answer because there, you know, a lot of the drivers of various malignancies are kinases or phosphatases or molecules that actually can be modulated by small molecules. And so selecting those small molecules to treat the cancer appropriately, you know, is an immediate practical utility of the testing, right? So for constitutional, since every cell in your body has the same problem, you know, or most cells in your body, let's say, depending on the condition, but you have to fix a lot of cells, and fixing a lot of cells using fixing the gene in a lot of cells, and that's really a difficult problem. You know, using adeno-like viruses sets you up to the problem that your immune system kicks in, and you know, you can be treated once, and the next time you get treated, you basically destroy what you're treated with because your immune system kicks in, right? So now people are thinking about altering, injecting transfer RNAs that have different codon recognition characteristics, so they can fix, let's say, a stop codon. And so you don't have to fix the gene, you just have to make a little bit of the normal protein by putting in this modified transfer RNA, right? So bottom line is, you need to know what's wrong with you before you can even think about fixing things, right? There are several situations where knowing, you know, a deletion of a gene, thalassemia is, for example, when hemoglobin genes are missing, let's say, you could activate perfectly good copies of hemoglobin, well, you know, fetal hemoglobin, right? Next door, but all you need, you just have to activate that and you would be fine, right? But we, unfortunately, at the moment, we don't know how to do these things yet quite as well. But it's important to know what the problem is, because it tells you also how long, what's the prognosis of this condition, right? How it's going to evolve? Is it going to play out within a year? Is it going to play out a month? Or is it going to take decades, right? So I always think about it that way. People always try to find out the future, right? Everybody talks about horoscopes. Are you a yes. Leo, or are you a Virgo, or God knows,
I'm
right?
a Gemini. So.
Or the Chinese, are you a monkey or are you a rabbit? Right.
Yep, your birth years, yeah.
But really, the only prediction you can make about yourself is not in the stars, it's in your DNA, right? So it's nice to know, let's say, that you carry a gene, a mutation, that will cause you potentially deadly breast cancer by age 30, or ovarian cancer, or it can give you colon cancer by 50, you know, or testicular cancer by 30 or 40, or I can go on. There are multiple, you know, dozens of such situations where actually knowing your genetic composition can save your life. Now you can say, okay, I don't care. Whatever happens, happens, right? But I'm in the group of people who likes to know what I can change, you know, I look both ways before I cross the street, and so I would recommend people to be aware of their genetic issues before it gets to them and kills them. Not to mention, you know, the other thing that we do with these methods, we don't just use it for diagnostic purposes, but we use it for carrier testing purposes. And, you know, a lot of the hardest part of my work is to actually communicate to, let's say, parents who have a child who is like 5-6 year old and has been doing perfectly fine and suddenly just falls apart and dies, right? And telling them that this is going to happen because this child carries a homozygous or a compound heterozygous mutation that will lead to sudden and irreversible intellectual demise and neurological demise, right? So you want to avoid causing these kind of issues in your children, and hence, as a parent, the heartbreak for yourself. I mean, SMA is one of the most heartbreaking disorders, right? Spinal muscular atrophy. You need to know whether you're a carrier for that or not. I think it's very good, especially if you are from a population where your parents, grandparents, and ancestors, you know, were in a closed environment, either geographically or culturally. You know, you don't know how closely related you really are to your partner. What Praxis Genomics is doing, and why I actually started Praxis Genomics to a great extent, because I was seeing a lot of these horrible neurological recessive conditions that were perfectly preventable by doing carrier testing, but not the standard carrier testing where you just test for, you know, 300 variants or whatever, 300 genes even. A lot of these, the 40, 50%, depending on the population, these kids had a disease that would not have been picked up by a targeted genetic testing, right? Targeted carrier testing, because they were family-specific variants and so rare that, you know, maybe one or two has been described in the whole world. So that is the reason why I started Praxis Genomics, to provide a lab that actually approaches things almost as a scientific, you know, sort of study. Every patient is like a scientific study. That's why we do the optical genome mapping. That's why we do the repeat expansion stuff. That's why we do the whole genome sequencing, the transcriptome sequencing, because, and also now the long read technologies, because we want to provide a complete assessment that is analyzed by a single person, not sending out the test request to 10 different labs and then they all come back negative. You know, because alone, none of these tests are foolproof. They have to be analyzed together. The long read has to be analyzed together with the short read, together with the optical genome mapping, and preferably, you know, if you do the transcriptome. And so now the technology, relatively cheap, right? The sequencing itself is not the cost, but it's the knowledge and the time required to analyze properly these test subcomponents. And so I always get annoyed when people say, oh, you know, whole genome now is like $100, right? And then we should talk about the $0 whole genome. Well, that's okay. You can get that data, but you can't even open it. Very few people can actually even look at the data, let alone analyze it. And maybe in 20 years, artificial intelligence will be able to do that, when we already have a billion people genome sequenced and we know what's normal and we know what's not normal. But even then, because of the different types of the variants that there are so many different types, right? Point mutations, small indels, you know, larger indels. Nobody even looks currently at deletions in between 50 base pair and 10,000 base pair. It's like a total blind spot. None of the big labs report out stuff because they can't verify the findings, right? So that's why you need optical genome mapping, so you can verify the structural findings you find. But again, it requires a focused and comprehensive analysis of all these data together to improve your diagnostic yield.
And that's what you guys do at Praxis, as you said, of just taking all of these different types of tests and saying, okay, we're going to combine the advantages to each test and the higher resolution here and being able to map and say, this is where this is versus another spot. You know, there's just so many advantages that comes with that, of having a lot of tools in your tool belt, as we say. But this has just been great. I have learned so much, more than an average interview. I really just appreciate all of your insight with this, and people can check out Praxis Genomics to learn more and see everything that you guys offer.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Kyra. I'm very happy that you learned something, and I'm hopeful that actually people understand that the future of a person is not in the stars, but to a large degree in their DNA. and it's knowable. And it's going to be easier and easier to get to know it. So with that, I think, thank you again. And maybe we can meet again at some point.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.